He's got to navigate that space in between. And there is much self-control that is needed. You can see why he would say temperate, prudent, all those kinds of things. Okay? 1 Timothy 5:23, take a little wine, Timothy, for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. Is that a command to drink socially? No. Don't let anybody talk about it that way. Don't talk about that verse that way. That was first century medicinal language. Timothy, you got stomach issues. A little wine with that might help. Okay, so requires a ton of self-control. And here's something to think about. Think carefully about the perceptions of others. Remember, we talked about each one of these lies in the perceptions of others. You can't control how other people might perceive your use of alcohol. You can't. Can you imagine another man justifying his ungodly use of alcohol because he saw you, the elder, drinking alcohol? He may not know what your temperate, prudent, self-controlled, measured, careful thinking is, but you're drinking and he sees you drinking and his way of drinking is not what your way of drinking is, and he feels validated. Be very careful. If you want to be an elder someday, you're not now, and alcohol is a part of your life, you need to think very carefully now about what other people perceive of your use of alcohol to be. The man may not be able to discern the difference between the self-controlled way that you are using alcohol and the ungodly way he uses alcohol is. He may actually equate your measured use of it with his thoughtless way of using it. You got to be really careful. Okay? Not pugnacious. It's in Titus 1:7 as well. Literally, it means not a striker. One who's not ready to settle every conflict with fisticuffs, throwing blows, physical intimidation, violence. It's difficult to imagine ever escalating. You probably would think about this, oh my goodness, I would never throw a blow at somebody over a disagreement. I can't imagine ever doing that. How could it ever escalate to that? Let me give you a description of what kind of man is willing to become physically aggressive. Okay, here's a description of a man who's willing to become physically aggressive. Number one, what has to happen for that man? He needs to be in conflicts. He needs to be in disagreements. He probably will be sinned against. He might be disregarded. He might be ignored. He might be slandered. And I say, welcome to eldering. The man who's going to throw a blow is not a man that everybody loves and agrees with all the time. It's the guy who's disagreed with a lot, who finds himself ignored, disregarded. That man will be the one who eventually, potentially, will throw blows. Number two, it's the man who doesn't deal biblically with those conflicts. He's in those kind of conflicts, he has those kinds of disappointments, and he doesn't deal biblically with them. And they begin to take root in his heart. He has unconfessed sin regarding the conflict. This man also, number three, would be a man overcome then with pride. He thinks far too highly of himself than he ought. There's too much self-importance. He's too important to be disregarded. Who do they think they are? I'm an elder. And that man, number four, is a ticking time bomb. You put all of that together and that man is an unstable cocktail that will explode in violence. Now, it may not come with a throwing of a blow first. You might first hear from that man a veiled threat. You might then get yelled at by that man. You might even get that man stepping up close to you, physically in proximity, just like intimidating you. It might come to a push. Can you imagine a man at that point? If something like that ever, if an elder ever did that, how does he ever get back trust from the sheep? What are the sheep going to do around that guy? They're going to get in karate stance to protect. Can you imagine the sheep having to protect themselves from a shepherd? It all goes back to, look, if you're going to become an elder, you are going to be in constant conflict and disappointments, and you're going to be sinned against, and people are going to have issue with you. You got to take care of it there. Because if you don't, it will become something physical down the line. Okay? Gentle is the next word. You can see why he would put that right after pugnacious. Instead, the contrast is he needs to be gentle. That means kind, gracious, mild, fair, tolerant, considerate, forbearing, all of those kinds of ideas. The English word gentle in our minds carries with itself the idea of a softness or a tenderness. And that's great for English, but the Greek leans more towards the idea of fairness or moderateness. That's what it means, gentleness. I like this translation, sweet reasonableness. There is a sweet reasonableness to the man. It's a man who can be reasoned with. He's gentle in that sense. Contrast that with a man who always operates with strict justice. A man who is always unduly rigorous in every single moment, in every single situation. He's unreasonable. You can't reason with him because, no, there's this and this and this, and that's just the way we do it. There's nothing reasonable about that. It's a man who is strict. The opposite of this would be a man who is strict to dispense justice at every moment rather than being gentle or generous in his treatment of others. Being gentle means having to wait. It means having to allow for multiple possible cases to be considered in whatever the scenario is before the man. The situation might not be what it first appears to be, and so a gentle man is moderate. He's restrained. He'll be quick to pardon. He'll be willing to endure injustice for a time. He'll be willing to rise above whatever injustice is going on in the moment to measure what it is before him that's going on carefully. You contrast that man with the one who is marked by severity all the time. He's rigid. He's exacting. He doesn't want to take the time to question his immediate desire for a strict justice. That's not a gentle man. Peaceable is the next word in verse 3. Peaceable. To put it in a negative way, it's uncontentious. This man is uncontentious. This is a man who's not looking always to draw lines in the sand to divide people. Oh yeah, well, what do you think about this doctor? Let me draw it in a line. Okay, you're on that side. I just want to make that clear. Everybody, he's over on that side of the line. And that's not a man who's peaceable. That's a man who's separating people. Unity is being sacrificed. He is a man, a peaceable man, is a man who can be made peace with. Among the elders, and especially among the church body, peaceableness does not just automatically happen. I don't know if you've noticed that. It's an uphill climb to get to peaceableness. Guess what's a downhill slide? Contentiousness. Division. Separating from one another. Silent treatment to one another. You don't even have to work for that to happen. That's just going to happen if you don't pay attention to it. But you have to climb for and stretch for and work for peaceableness. Elder needs to be a man who loves peace. And the elder needs to be a man who knows the path to peace. I mean, he can see a division going on. He can see disunity. And he's got a plan how to get from there to peace. One of the main differences between the church and the world is not that they have war with one another and we don't. They disagree with one another and they have conflict and we don't. What's the difference between us and the world? What should be one of the differences? When we have conflict, what? We make peace. We find a way to make peace. The church must not be the way the world is, and the elders need to lead by example on how to be peaceable with one another. Next, in verse 3, the last one, free from the love of money. If a man, if what the man loves is money, then you know what the office will become to him? If really the love of his life is money, and you put the office in front of him, what will he use the office for? Money. To get money. And elders will deal with money. I mean, think about if Paul loved money. Think about if Timothy loved money. What did he have all of them go do? All of his co-laborers with him on the second mission or the third missionary journey. He had them go back through all of the places in Macedonia and Achaia and the European continent and through Galatian region, and they all took offerings from the church. There's no way that they carried a bag of coins. There would have been way too many. So I was just reading this week. What they probably did is the banks back then would write a note, and then they could go to another bank, and that bank would have to be able to provide that, or you have to go to several banks to be able to provide that. So imagine these guys. There are seven men traveling with Paul. They got tons of money for their day in their pockets. And if they saw, if they were driven by a love for money and then you put them into an office of sorts, they're only going to use their office to advance their love for money. And we can see that in our day with false teachers using the office to what? Rake in millions. When I was in South Africa last summer and driving through the township, so I have to just get outside of Johannesburg or outside of any city, and there are these townships that are deplorable places, difficult places to live. And in every single one, there's a banner up on the side of the road for preacher so-and-so, prosperity living. And even though they're all living in shacks, they're all giving their money away to the guy. I heard a story of a guy say a grown man had moved out from his mom's shack and he had his own shack. And his mom had saved up and saved up and saved up and saved up and actually bought him a mattress so he didn't have to sleep on the dirt. So she gave her son the mattress. And the man fell under the influence of the false teacher in the place, and he decided that what he needed to do was sell his mattress so that he could give the money to God. And that kind of thing is going on. It's not dealing with thousands of dollars, hundreds of dollars. It's nickel and diming these poor people to death. Benny Hinn is everywhere across South, all over Africa doing this. It's horrible. The expectation for the body is also in Hebrews 13:5. If you want to write that down, that's the general qualification for the body or character quality for the body to have as well. But the elder is to be exemplary in this character issue. Hebrews 13:5. Verses 4 and 5 now of 1 Timothy. Here's a transition from what he is to what he does in his home, from general, everywhere character qualities to specific household abilities. That's what Paul wants to now make the transition on. This man is now going to be measured primarily by how he provides leadership over his household. And this is an argument from the lesser to the greater. It's from his own household to God's household. What's his leadership like over some in his household to what his leadership would be like over many? It is the submission of a few in his house to the submission of many under him in the church. One who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. The verb manages there means literally standing before. Standing before in leadership. It's superintending leadership. He's near enough to stand over it and oversee what's going on in the home. There are two components to this leadership management. Number one, authority is involved. And number two, nearness to the household is involved. Authority and nearness to the household is involved. So it's not about authority for authority's sake. It's not authority that's absent of watchful, near care. But it's also not about, I just care, I'm president, I care for you, absent of the idea of authority. The man must see himself as one who has authority and who will step near to his family to care for them from that authority. The man needs to see himself as one with both of those things. And he is to manage well his household. That means aesthetically good authority and good care. There's a beauty, there's an attractiveness to the way that he manages his home. His management is effective, and it's done in such a way that it's actually appealing. It's attractive. It's engaging. And what is the evidence that he is managing his household well? It's given to us right here. Keeping his children under control with all dignity. The children of a potential elder, guess what, guys? They need to be observed. The children need to be observed for what? How well they respond to dad. But the point in observing them is to draw a conclusion about dad and his management, not the child's character. Under control, keeping them under control, means to keep them in submission. It's to line up in a line under somebody. They follow dad. The opposite would be the children are leading dad around, and dad is following up underneath them, and they control him. In other words, with this, managing well and keeping children under control is the idea that it's clear who is in charge in the home and who is not in charge. Submission is easily identified in the children, and authority is easily identified in the dad. The children are embracing submission to authority, to dad's authority. How does the man gain their submission? It says here it needs to be done with all dignity. With all dignity modifies him and the way that he is keeping them under control. It doesn't modify the children. It's not that the children need to be with all dignity. The man's keeping them under control is with all dignity. What do you look for from the children? If you're considering a man for elder, what do you look for in the children? You look for submission. You look for being under control. What do you look for in the man? A dignified way in which he does that. In the way in which he gains their submission. Listen, submission can be gained in a number of undignified ways, can it not? You can intimidate your children into submission. You can, with anger, manipulate them into submission. You can use the silent treatment to get them into submission. And all of that is undignified. How did Jesus gain the submission of his followers? Matthew 11, 28 to 30. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. I am gentle and humble of heart. He makes it appealing to put a yoke on your own neck around to follow him. There's engaging leadership that he provides. So there's no doubt who's in authority and who is in submission when it comes to Jesus and his followers. There should be no doubt in the home of the elder as well. So guys, listen, I don't know if my sense in the younger generation under me of guys, especially in the church, is that authority is poo-pooed. I'm just going to be a gentle guy. And by that, I'm not going to really like be authoritarian. I think maybe a younger generation automatically equates authoritarianism is authority. Authority is always authoritarianism. And it's not. You should embrace authority when God gives you authority. And you should run from authority if God doesn't give you authority. But if God has given you authority as a husband and as a dad, you should embrace it and not be a jerk with it. But you should embrace authority and step near to your house in care. And then in verse 5, if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? Here's the argument from the lesser to the greater in this qualification, right? So here's some questions for you to consider. Guys, do you embrace the authority that God has given to you in your home? Or do you just kind of go through your day and your week and you haven't really even thought about, I'm the one who's in authority here? Do you actually embrace it? And then another question would be, are you near enough to your family to see how and where they need to be cared for by you in your position of authority? Because those two things have to go together. You have authority and you must be near to them. And you care for your family from your position of authority. When you gain the submission of your children, do you do it with dignity? Best person to ask that is your wife. And if your kids are old enough, ask them. They'll be honest with you. They'll also try to say to you that any expression that you've ever given of them to gain control of them is evil. They'll want to maybe make you work through that first, and then you'll have to go, oh, wait a minute. No, that's not true. So you got to watch out for them. They're sneaky sometimes. Do observers of my authority in my home, would people describe my authority of my home as appealing, engaging, attractive, dignified? Verse 6, not a new convert, so that he will not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. New convert means he can't be a beginner in the faith. He can't be a recent convert to Christ. What's the potential temptation before other elders or the church to make a new convert an elder? When does that happen? You know when something like that happens in our day? It happens when we perceive that the new convert really could have a position of influence. Wow! Did you see what sports star just came to Christ? Did you the celebrity? Man, imagine if he were an elder or if he was in a position of leadership here. I mean, can you imagine? That's the temptation that can take place. There's a perceived influence that the new convert may have. Everyone thinks that type of person, or if it's just a huge business guy, a well-known business guy, and he comes to Christ. I mean, that type of person, to many Christians, almost has magical powers. Or you could just be super encouraged by the passion and the zeal that for all things Bible that a new believer has. And that's great. You don't want to quench any of that, but that's not a reason to make one of them an elder right away. What does Paul say the new convert is especially vulnerable to? What does he say in verse 6? Conceit, pride, thinking more highly of himself than he ought. To come in as one so new to Christ and then yet to be put up so high so quickly in the church in an office of elder, that's not helpful for him. It's not helpful at all. And what's the terrible potential outcome for the new convert? If he does become arrogant as an elder, he'll fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. The devil fell because he thought too highly of himself. He was prideful. And every other fall in the human race that is due to pride is somehow a reflection of the fall of Satan. And can you imagine this? How sad that the fall of Satan in pride would be reflected by an elder who's young in the faith. Verse 7, he must have a good reputation with those outside the church so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. He mentioned the devil again. In two qualifications, he mentions the devil. In two qualifications, he mentions the devil. I just let that sink in. Why do outsiders or unbelievers matter when measuring an elder's qualification? Because that's where the gospel is going, right? That's where the gospel's going. Mark, would you do me a favor and just shut the door? I think the drama people are coming, and they keep coming in here. And heaven forbid, we can't have them hear the truth. So that'll just help them. So the gospel is going towards outsiders. An elder whose ungodly behavior has maybe even helped harden an unbeliever there out in the world, that's unacceptable. Think about who spends time, the most time, with an elder each week. And I would be speaking about a lay elder at this point, one who's not paid to be, maybe separated out in an office, counseling, studying, caring for people. Think about the lay elder. Who spends more time with that elder each week? Unbelieving co-workers or the church family? A lot of unbelievers. Denny, how much time do you spend with your small group compared to how many unbelievers you're around at work? I mean, it doesn't even compare, right? So what a man truly is actually going to come out where? In small group time? Now, let's face it. What do we all do when we go to small group? We try to be honest. We try to be transparent. We're striving for that. But we always also what? We put our best foot forward all the time. But when you're out working in a stressful situation and you're spending 40, 50, 60 hours with those people, your true character comes out eventually, right? So God here is intended to let there be an avenue of measurement into an elder that comes from unbelievers. Isn't that interesting? And again, the devil's brought up. Listen, if the Holy Spirit is the one who makes men overseers, Acts 20:28, the devil is involved in disqualifying them. God himself and the Spirit is making men elders. The devil's trying to unmake them elders or never get them qualified to be elders. And he's setting traps. He'll fall into the reproach and the snare or the trap of the devil. If there is an accusation against an elder from someone outside the church, the elders need to listen carefully to what the accusation is. Because Jesus had a lot of accusations against him from unbelievers, but that doesn't mean that he was unqualified. You need to discern what the accusation is. Now let's hop over to Titus chapter 1, and we'll cover as much as we can here. Yeah.
What does that look like?
I don't know. I don't think there is. Except, which is interesting, it's a term that, you know, he didn't put months on it, he didn't put years on it. And I think that means that each place, each setting has to really wrestle through what that means. It might look a little differently in the Do tribe in PNG than it looks here. But they have to wrestle with what that means.
In the book of Acts, just is there any kind of way to draw a timeline when they appoint elders? Is this 2 years?
Yeah. Acts 14, but I've kind of, in Acts 14, when Paul goes through on his first missionary journey in the southern Galatian region through Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, and those places, and he comes back through and it says that he appointed elders in each one.
So how long is that?
We don't know. Not very much time, but here's what we do know, that you can't exclude in this. Where did he always go first? In every city. Synagogues. What kind of people could you have found in that time in synagogues? A genuine Yahweh believer who maybe had believed all of his life in Yahweh, having a faith that's anticipating Messiah, and now here comes a man telling us Messiah's name is Jesus. And that man's faith, genuine saving faith, transitions into not Messiah anticipating faith, but now Messiah knowing faith. And I think it's very possible that it was those men that they would have made elders. That's in between the lines, but I'm not ready to say either way that it was only those men, and I'm not prepared to say that there weren't some other men. But I'm not quick to say, well, it was a short period of time, so we don't really need to have a lengthy period either. Got to be really careful and guard that. So Titus 1:5, for this reason I left you, Titus, in Crete, that you would set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city as I directed you. And the gist of what's going on, I'm going to skip through a lot in verse 5 there. The point is, Paul had been through the island of Crete with Titus and had Timothy with him. He and Timothy went on to Ephesus, and then Paul went on back up into the Macedonian region and stuff like that. And he's writing to Titus, and he left Titus on the island of Crete to set the church in order. He gave him directions, and now he is putting in writing the very directions that Titus knew that he was supposed to carry out. And there are some things that are undone in those cities, in those churches across the island of Crete. There are some things that remain. There are some things that are undone. And the first thing that's on his mind is appoint elders. In other words, in Paul's mind, a church was left undone if it did not have what? Biblically qualified men serving as elders. So when we go to the mountains of Papua New Guinea and we plant a church, when is that church? What's a measurement? What's a marker that we'll help know? We'll know when that church is established. When it what? Has its own qualified elder leadership, as they have determined it there. Appoint elders in every city. How many cities were supposed to have churches without elders? Every city. City by city. Church by church. Now let's talk about verse 6. If any man is above reproach. It's a different word. There's a whole word family for above reproach or beyond criticism or blameless. There's a whole word family. This is another one, but the idea is similar. It's the idea of he's unaccused. He has a character or conduct that's free from any accusation. You can try to throw an accusation at him, but he's got a Teflon character and it doesn't stick. Okay? Husband of one wife, we talked about that in chapter 3, verse 2, so we won't go over that. Let's talk about, and if all we cover here this morning as we finish up is having children who believe, that would be a good place for us to be at. The NAS says having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. I want you to write down, let's talk about that word believe, and write down the word faithful. Faithful. And then write down these verses. Matthew 25, verse 23. Matthew 25, verse 23. Listen, this is Jesus' parable. And the master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Write down 1 Corinthians chapter 4. verse 17. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 17. For this reason, I have sent to you Timothy, who is my beloved and faithful child in the Lord. Now, does Paul mean to say that he's my believing child? No, he means to say he's saying something about the man. He's faithful, just like the slave in Jesus' parable was a faithful slave. Write down 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. You know this. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man, and God is a believer. No, God is faithful. It says something about his character. He's faithful. And the context determines whether or not it is good character or not. How about 1 Timothy 1:15? 1 Timothy 1:15. It is a trustworthy statement, deserving full acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, among whom I am foremost of all. It is a trustworthy statement. It is a faithful statement. He's not trying to say that the statement believes. So in other words, the word here, the word family, in fact, it's in Titus 1, verse 9. It's the faithful word. He's not trying to say that the word believes. It's just an adjective that is overwhelmingly translated as faithful. Now, the word can also be translated as believe, but the word's presence itself does not demand that you go with the definition of believe for it. This measurement here in Titus chapter 1 is very much like the one in 1 Timothy 3 for the children that were described there. In 1 Timothy 3, the children are not described as believers, but they are described by their conduct under their father's leadership. And the word faithful in Titus 1, verse 6, fits that same idea, very much so. What's in view here in Titus 1, 6 is not the child's status as a believer or not, but how the child is living under the father's spiritual leadership. Think about how insane this is. The man must be this. The man must be this. Wait a minute, full stop. Does his child believe? All of a sudden, can you control whether or not your child believes? Can you control if you're a dignified man? Can you control if you're temperate? Can you control if you're self-controlled? Yes, all of those things fall under your purview, your responsibility. Should you labor with the gospel in your child's life? Yes, but you may labor all the days of your life and not see fruit. So the word faithful is a better translation than believe. The emphasis in Titus 1 is on the effect of the man's leadership on his children, and that is what the qualification's after. The child's faithfulness under his father's leadership says something about the man's leadership character, regardless of whether the child is saved or not. Now, how do we know that? We know that from the word can just be translated faithful, and the word faithful points in that direction. But we also know by what follows what Paul says here. Having children who believe. How are the children described? By their conduct. Not accused of dissipation or rebellion. Two negative terms used here. Dissipation means that the child does not have wasteful, reckless, extravagant living. The child is not incapable of being influenced by restraint. The child can be influenced by restraint. It means boundless debauchery. There's no boundary set on it. It's like the prodigal son who just ran as far as he could into wasteful living. And this description requires from the child a level of maturity. It requires somebody to have a maturity that says, I know what the boundaries are, and I know what you're saying, and I'm not going there. In fact, I'm going to go stretch this as far as I can. That requires a level of maturity. It's probably an older child, older than the one in 1 Timothy 3. The second word is rebellion. That's a refusal to be subject to authority. It refuses to submit to parental authority. It's personal unruliness. You put both of these two words together and you have the description of a wild, uncontrolled lifestyle. How old of a child does he need to be? Well, probably it's a child still in the home, since in Titus chapter 1, verse 6, he says that he has these children. It doesn't mean that his wife had a baby and he has a child. It means that he still possesses the child, probably in his home, but the child's probably older than the 1 Timothy 3 child. Okay? How does a young child become this older, rebellious child? Number one, dad didn't manage his child well when he was younger, 1 Timothy 3. He didn't, in a dignified way, keep his children under submission to him. Secondly, dad didn't set self-control for his child as a goal to aim at. Listen, if you do not put before your children the goal of self-control, they won't go there. Did you? Did you want to just naturally go to self-control? You have to set it before them. And if a dad never puts self-control before his son or his daughter, you can't expect that the child will actually get there. Thirdly, how does a young child become this older rebellious child? Dad restrained the child very little when the child lacked inward ability to restrain himself. Listen, I love the way that Smed talks about it. You can either have self-control right now, or you can have daddy control. Okay? You can either control yourself, and when you can't control yourself, then there will be daddy control. Okay? That's a great way of thinking about it. A dad who doesn't ever use daddy control will find his son or his daughter in time when they get a little older, a little more mature, a little more sophisticated, really pushing the envelope. Number four, dad allowed the child to have a low view of God-given authority in the home. You need to help your children understand that there's authority. That doesn't mean you're an authoritarian freak. It doesn't mean that you're a dictator. It doesn't mean that you are everything that you're trying to stay away from in your mind of bad ideas of authoritarianism. It just means that God gives you authority and your children need to understand that. And fifthly, there was no discipline, or either there was meaningless discipline or ineffective discipline. I heard a dad say the other day that mom spanked one of their older kids, and the child laughed at mom. And they're like, okay, that's not strong enough. So anyway, if whatever discipline is there, if it doesn't bring about an effect, it's meaningless. It's ineffective. So, having children who are faithful. That's our view of it here. There are other churches, there are other men, really godly men, who I tremble to think of disagreeing with, who believe that this is, no, the children must be believers. Well, you know what? Before you become an elder, then make sure all your kids have been born, and make sure all your kids have grown up and have believed, have been baptized, and are walking and show consistent fruit. Don't even think about becoming an elder before then. Because if you have a baby as an elder, not a believer, and now you're disqualified. There's a radical inconsistency, I think, in this, which these great men who have this position do not see and can explain that away, I'm sure, in a way that I just set it up as a really cheap straw man. So probably not really wise of me to do that. Okay, let me see. What else, if anything, would I want to say? Let me just close with this. Guys, we didn't get through all the rest of them. Notice self-willed in verse 7. Notice sensible in verse 8. That's the same as prudent back in 1 Timothy 3:2. And notice at the end of verse 8, self-controlled. Okay, so you got temperate. You've got prudent or sensible. You can't be self-willed, and you got to be self-controlled. There are at least four qualifications that have to do with the man doing what? Controlling himself. Guess who an elder's greatest adversary is in his qualification? Himself. It's not the elder sitting next to you at the table. It's not that family who just won't let up on you. It's not that situation. It's not that. The greatest threat to your qualification is you. It's me. We need to be men who are self-controlled. This is why you must shepherd your heart and bring your heart before the Word of God on a daily basis. And guys, if God never leads you to the office of deacon, if He never leads you to the office of elder, that's okay. But you got to be godly. And our prayer for you men is that in time, perhaps many of you will find that you have a desire within you that will not go away, and you want to care for God's people. in an office of shepherding. So that's what we're aiming for here. Any questions, guys, or comments or a clarification you want? And guys, the last thing I would want you to think going away is, oh my goodness, that's the godly man and that's not me. We all need to grow, and God has you where you are, and he has you taking the steps that he has you taking the steps in. And take another step today. Take another step today. He gave you today. We have no idea what tomorrow brings. We have no idea if tomorrow even comes or if you'll see tomorrow. If you do, you'll live and you'll breathe. But today he's given you this day only. Take another step in godliness. Okay? Let's pray. Father, that's what we want today. Would you help us, please? I thank you for these men. I pray that you'd bless their pursuit of you and that you would raise up in this church qualified men to the office of shepherd. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, guys. Thank you. I'm guessing there's going to be some people who want to get in here, so eat the food, but be ready for others to come in and put on a play or something.